This is the challenge we need to meet, and our plan will meet this moment.
The Prime Minister says this is a budget about fairness. Fairness for every generation. Kind of wording that's meant to appeal to younger voters who seem to be fleeing the Liberals in droves. So that's what the government sees this budget as being about. Well, the Canadians might see things a little bit differently. But it is fair to ask, I guess, what does fairness actually mean in this context? Is there a focus on growing the economy? Is there a focus in this budget on improving Canada's rather weak productivity? There doesn't seem to be. The budget talks about how the economy is doing well or better than expected. But what are they doing to try to strengthen that? Is that a missed opportunity here? Well, joining us for some thoughts on this particular issue and some thoughts on the budget more generally, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Andrew Coyne, columnist for the Globe and Mail, theglobeandmail.com. You can find his latest. Andrew, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Ron.
But what does this budget seem to be about, as far as you can tell, what the focus seems to be?
Well, it has obviously heavily political, but they all are, but especially when a government is as in much trouble politically as this government is, back, you know, 20 points behind its leading contender, they're throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this, particularly a focus on housing. And that's well taken. It's a little late in the day to be doing it, but there are some useful proposals in there. But as you were suggesting off the top, the biggest failing in the budget and the failing of every previous budget from this government is they just don't seem to get it on the urgent need to improve Canadian productivity and Canadian growth rates, which you know, has been a problem for 40 years or more, but has gotten particularly acute in the last few years. At the moment, we can least afford it. We are heading into, or we're in the midst of, this transition of the baby boom generation reaching retirement age, reaching the age at which you encounter a lot more health problems. So huge increases in costs ahead of us. So, you know, at the very moment when we really need to get serious about growing the economy so that we can have the revenues to pay those costs, growth has just basically turned negative, certainly in per capita terms.
Right.
So I think it's increasingly been seen. You see more and more commentators, most lately the deputy governor of the Bank of Canada, saying it was a productivity emergency. And yet in this budget, there's no really serious proposals for addressing that. It's the same approach that we've seen in previous governments where you throw a lot of money at R&D, you throw a lot of money at particular sectors that you think look good on the government, so artificial intelligence or, you know, clean economy stuff. But that's not the kinds of measures you need. If you're going to get a $3 trillion economy to lift up off of the floor and take flight, you're going to need a lot more radical measures than that. So that's the biggest disappointment in the budget, is just this failure to come to grips with the growth crisis.
You know, it's a dilemma, I think, for the government on a number of fronts, housing being one, this being another, and I think there are more than just those two, where do you acknowledge that there's a problem? Because there's a political problem in acknowledging that you've been around for almost 9 years and things are bad, versus being seen as out of touch, right? You're ignoring something that the Canadians have identified as a problem. So to what extent on this, Andrew, is there denial on the government's part?
Well, on that one, there is. And what you see with this government and with a lot of governments is you'll see a lot of phrasing of, we must continue to do, or we must do even more of, which is sort of code for we haven't been doing enough, but you don't want to admit it. Now, what's been interesting on things like housing and even more on immigration is some of the government ministers talk as if somebody else was in power the last 9 years. So
right.
the language and the rhetoric that comes out is, oh, my God, things are in a mess here. And you almost feel like they're going to run, you know, as Pierre Poilievre, which I wouldn't put past them. I mean, you might say, oh, come on, nobody's going to be fooled by that fact. But in a democracy, you never know till you try.
Right.
And sometimes these things have been pulled off. I think the dilemma they're facing is that the Prime Minister himself is in such bad odor with the public. And there's a point at which, and this, nothing is certain, but there's a point at which people just tune you out.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing that you say and no proposals that you make really have much impact. And I guess we'll have to see whether that's what's happened now, but there's certainly a strong whiff of that in the air.
There's a lot of spending in this budget. There are attempts to pay for some of that spending we can get to, but how is spending tracking in your view? How reckless would you say some of this spending is?
Well, I think we were conditioned, unfortunately, by the experience of the 80s and 90s, those of us who were around for that, that if it wasn't an absolute five-alarm fire, IMF showing up at your door crisis in terms of spending and deficits and debt, then it didn't really matter. And that way lies perdition, because if you're too complacent about it and you leave yourself too exposed, there's that old line from Hemingway of, how did you go bankrupt, gradually then suddenly. Yeah. So you can be sailing along and thinking you're fine, and then stuff you didn't expect, like a major war or a spike in interest rates. I mean, remember, we were all told until fairly recently that we didn't need to worry about the debts we were racking up because interest rates were at historic lows. And suddenly, lo and behold, interest rates aren't at historic lows, and now we're spending $50 to $60 billion a year on interest costs when 3 years ago it was $20 billion. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty hefty change of plans that's involved there. And if you look at the growth in interest costs, the growth in costs of the elderly benefits, and the growth in costs of transfers of health care, all those things are expanding and basically squeezing out everything else in the budget. So it's not that it's fantastically reckless. It's just it's sailing too close to the wind. It requires everything to go right. You're leaving yourself very little margin of error. So, on their projections, the debt-to-GDP ratio continues to decline, or resumes declining, I guess, this year, and continues to. But if there's anything we should have known from this government particularly, all governments are guilty of it to an extent, but this government in particular, is their projections are not worth the paper they're written on, especially on spending. So every 6 months, there's either a budget or a fall economic statement, and every single time that they do that, you find that spending has increased another $10, $12, $13 billion a year. It's been revised upward. And the trick, and I've been sort of hammering on this for a while now, is every time they issue a spending forecast with a curve on a graph, and the curve is very gently rising. It's on a very, shallow slope, not a steep slope at all. And so people look at that and go, oh, spending's only going to increase 2 or 3% a year. It's all under control. And what they hope you don't notice is every time they issue one of those curves, the whole curve moves up another $10 or $12 billion.
Right.
So it's a kind of a baseline shift trick that I think has stopped working for them. But for a while there, it was you would still see people saying, oh, this looks like a fiscally conservative budget, even though every number in it had been radically revised upward just since the previous forecast 6 months ago. So you sort of wonder, what's the point of issuing these forecasts? The forecasts are supposed to take into account rising spending needs, and yet the forecasts are obsolete, almost as soon as they're issued.
In recent years, certainly, I mean, the government was content to borrow to pay for all of this spending. At least, I guess you could argue that they're attempting now to pay for some of this, to find revenue sources to cover some of this spending. And maybe there were worse ways they could have gone about it, but nonetheless, there is a considerable new tax increase in this budget. What did you make of that?
Well, as you say, it's probably better than letting the deficit rip. I would have preferred, obviously, there was more discipline on the spending. We're certainly not short of revenues. Mm-hmm. The particular tax increase they brought in is an increase in the inclusion rate on capital gains from 1/2 to 2/3. And not to get too technical with people, but there's actually a case for that if it was part of a larger tax reform. What you want, the sort of gold standard of all tax policy, is you want tax to be neutral. You don't want people making decisions about where to invest, et cetera, based on the string of tax goodies that are attached to each of these things, because then they're not paying attention to the economic fundamentals.
Yeah.
They're just trying to get, money from the taxpayer. So from that standpoint, you want to tax every source of income, whether it's capital gains or dividends or anything else, the same rate. And actually, if you move from 1/2 to 2/3, it probably gets you closer to that. The problem is, if you're just doing it in isolation and not as part of a broader tax reform where you're closing tax preferences and cutting tax rates, it may be defensible as policy in isolation, but in a larger context of higher spending, continued large deficits, and you're sort of solving your problems by raising taxes, particularly with the kind of soak the rich rhetoric that was attached to it, it doesn't send great signals. And you have to be conscious of the signaling effect of policy as much as the nuts and bolts of it. At a time when, as I say, we are suffering from a shortfall of investment, the reason why we're doing so poorly in our productivity and growth versus other countries is our workers have much less capital to work with because our investment rates are so anemic. You should be doing absolutely everything, both in hard policy terms and in signaling terms, to say we want more investment, more domestic investment, more foreign investment, and we're going to do everything we can to make that make this a congenial place to invest. It doesn't send the great signal. So it's sort of similar to the, and they may find it's really similar, to the small business tax changes they were going to make a few years ago before that blew up on them. But those policies, in isolation, were some of it was defensible. But you'd have a much better time of this, and I think we really are getting to the stage in this country where we need to talk about a much broader, more sweeping tax reform. That's better in terms of policy, but it's also more politically doable. And I think that's the lesson that politicians should learn from these affairs is when you try to do just one tax reform at one time, you basically create a lot of people who've got their nose out of joint because they're going to lose from it, and you don't have anybody who's gaining from it.
Yeah.
And what you want with a broader tax reform is that the losers are balanced off by the winners, and you know, you make it more politically possible as well as sounder policy.
Well, there's the politics of it. It almost kind of reminds me of the gun control issue where the liberals have convinced themselves that, you know, they can announce anything. It doesn't really matter. They'll benefit. It boxes the conservatives in because they wouldn't dare, you know, try to stake out the other side. I mean, does this accomplish any of that? Are there any of the optics or the politics of this budget you think help the liberals in any way?
Yeah, well, that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I would think on its own, sometimes these things have reverberated in different ways. On its own, my guess is if people perceive this as let's raise taxes on the rich, it will be very popular. People like that. If all they hear is the word tax and they don't, it doesn't resonate with them that they're hitting the rich, but they're hitting other people, that can get a little dicier. And as we saw with the small business thing, if a politically sympathetic group feels like they're getting their ox gored, correctly or otherwise, it can rebound on you badly for the government. So that's going to be interesting. Does the same constituency that got up in arms over the small business tax changes, some of the same people, if they start raising the roof over this, it's not just, in other words, you know, fat cats with monocles in their eyes, but the doctor or the lawyer or the dentist down the street, then that might cause them more grief, and I think that's still to be seen.
Indeed. Well, as mentioned, your latest, much more at theglobeandmail.com. Andrew, always a pleasure. Thanks for making some time for us here.
Thanks, Rob. Good to talk to you.
All the best. Likewise. Andrew Coyne, columnist of the Globe and Mail, theglobeandmail.com. Some thoughts from him on this budget. A lack of focus. As he concludes in his piece, he says, if you have 100 priorities, it is said you have none. Having spread itself so thin, budget after budget, on less urgent matters, the government finds itself without the capacity to act on the two or three things that really demand its attention. Well, concern is being raised about a symposium that Canada's Governor General recently held on an issue that relates directly to a piece of legislation currently before Parliament, compounded, I guess, by the fact that the Justice Minister himself was present at this symposium. Joining us to talk more about this issue, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Philippe Lagacé, Associate Professor and Barton Chair at Carleton University, the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs. Professor Lagacé, great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rob.
So let's start, before we get into it, you know, the general principle here, why it's so important for Canada's Governor General, whoever that is, Mary Simon or whoever else, to be impartial, to be above the politics of the day.
So impartiality is really a core function of this position. As the head of state representative, the Governor General exercises a number of important constitutional powers. As well, she is meant to represent the nation to itself. So on account of these two things, it's very important that this person, that office, be seen as above any particular partisan leaning or above the political fray, because there will be situations, particularly in the exercise of her constitutional powers, where there may be controversy around what decisions she made, how she used those powers, and there should never be any doubt in anybody's mind that she did so without any kind of favoritism or partiality towards one of the other parties. Similarly, because she is meant to represent Canadians to themselves in a non-political way, so this is why we have a separation between the head of state function and head of government function, everybody needs to be able to see themselves in this office. Mm-hmm. It has to be an office that is operates across ideological lines and partisan lines. And so anything that taints that impartiality should be avoided.
Right, which isn't to say that a governor general can't have causes or care about issues. Maybe it becomes a fine line in some respects, especially when we look at this issue, online abuse, safe digital spaces, which was the focus of the symposium. But where can the governor general be involved in causes?
So I would describe it as effectively what I would term banal benevolence. So we're talking about causes that are high level enough that most people can see themselves in it in some way, shape, or form, or issues that are clearly nonpartisan and across the board. So just as an example, here in Ontario, we had the legislature have a cross-party agreement on the importance of stamping out spousal abuse and conjugal violence. Now, that's an issue that could easily be taken up by Vice Regal because there's a cross-party consensus about it. And therefore, there's no real doubt that, you know, there's a debate about how serious the question is. By the same token, there's no legislation before the legislature on these types of issues. In Simon's case, she's been a champion of reconciliation, Indigenous reconciliation, mm-hmm. but that concept is so broad and means so many things to different people that she hasn't advocated for one particular form of it or what it might look like. She's just saying that this is an important cause. And here again, there's an overall consensus within Canada that reconciliation is a good thing, even if we fundamentally disagree in some cases about what that might look like. But as long as there's no clear political debate or legislation before Parliament, she can operate at that high level around this issue. The moment, though, that you're dealing with a question that is highly sensitive, the source of political debate between the parties, and as importantly, subject to a legislative debate or a bill in Parliament, then it's time for the Governor General to step back.
Which brings us to this. So Bill C-63 is the Online Harms Act. It's before Parliament right now. Last week, the Governor General hosted this symposium on, digital, creating safe digital spaces, online abuse, which, you know, are important issues. But this all seems to relate directly to this legislation. So we'll talk about some of the arguments, I guess, that, you know, defenders of the Governor General have put forth. But what stands out to you as the concern here?
So, as you mentioned, I don't think there's much doubt about the fact that online abuse is a scourge and it should be stamped out and it's something that we should avoid and that we need to do something about. I think we all agree with that. Where it becomes problematic is that the government has put forward a bill, C-63, which is highly controversial. The way in which you would address the question of online abuse and online harms has been questioned by the opposition parties, by a number of law professors, by civil liberties associations. A number of people are calling into question this bill. There's even doubts about whether or not it's compliant with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So for all these reasons, it's a very hot issue and one that's very contested. Now, in this context, to have the Governor General host this symposium, and even more problematically, to have the Justice Minister present at it and talking about his legislation, this, rightly or wrongly, just affects the impartiality of the Governor General when it comes to this legislation. It is seen that she is involving herself in an issue which is highly contentious at the moment.
Now, the Justice Minister was at this symposium, but he didn't speak. He wasn't invited to be a part of it. And what about the argument, though, that you know, the fault here lies with the Minister of Justice, that maybe he should have stayed away from this symposium, and that might have addressed some of these concerns? What do you make of that argument?
I agree he shouldn't have been there. I think that's step one. It would have been best if the Justice Minister not take part. It would have been best if no politicians or members of Parliament take part. But there's also a degree of responsibility that falls on the Governor General and her office here. They would have known that this is a highly sensitive topic. They would have invited the Justice Minister, and this is why he was there. they would have realized that there's a strong possibility that the justice minister or a member of his partisan political staff would seek to leverage this symposium to advance their legislation. These are all things that a prudent governor general and a prudent secretary of the governor general would have been aware of and would have said, you know what, the risk here to our impartiality is significant, and we should probably rethink our approach given that C-63 is before Parliament and how controversial it is.
Now, you know, we're coming off, and I don't think we can ignore the broader context here, where we're coming off, you know, various scandals involving previous governors general. Of course, you know, just over 3 years ago, we had a governor general actually resign. Is there some concern here, some broader concern about the credibility of the office, the importance of the institution, and maybe how Canadians perceive it right now?
I think that's correct. It's fair to say, as you pointed out, that this is an office that's now had a rough ride over the past few years. Madame Payette was a very controversial governor general. David Johnston has, having acted as a special rapporteur on foreign interference, has arguably done a bit of damage to his impartiality and reputation. Mm-hmm. And now we have Ms. Simon, who is wading into this. Equally important, though, I would point out that there seems to be concerns around whether or not this government understands the nature of this office. And that speaks to the Minister of Justice's decision to attend this symposium and his defense of linking his participation to the legislation. This demonstrates, to my mind, that this is a government that doesn't really put much stock in the importance of this office or its impartiality. And that has a trickle-down effect in terms of who they appoint and what they think are the correct boundaries around it.
So what can be done at this point? I mean, you know, the symposium's done. You know, there's no one doing it, but is there a way maybe we can learn from this or that the government or the Governor General's office can respond to this?
So both the Governor General's office and the Minister of Justice have doubled down on their
right
positions. So the Governor General said she's going to keep going forward. She's determined to keep this as a cause in spite of the criticism and in spite of the legislation. And the Minister of Justice has, you know, refused to acknowledge that maybe his presence and efforts to promote his bill as part of the symposium and speaking to people was out of line. So in that context, I do have concerns about what this will mean for the impartiality of the office or its perception. You do have the Conservatives now saying that it was inappropriate. They are being more careful in laying the blame squarely on the Justice Minister. Mm-hmm. But I just sincerely hope that we don't end up in a situation where Simon has to make an important constitutional call that, you know, could be seen as partial to one party or the other. And going forward, to be honest, I think we need a serious conversation about what we want from this office, because the other issue that's been hounding Ms. Simon has been the cost of her foreign trips.
Yeah.
Madame Payette's costs around the renovations of Rideau Hall were also an issue. So there's a lot of uncertainty around who we want in this position, how much we pay for it, what kind of pensions they get. I mean, there's a lot of debate to be had here for a not insignificant office of the Canadian state.
Yes, indeed. Well, let folks know you've written about these issues, a piece for Inside Policy at MacDonaldLaurier.ca. Professor Legace, thank you so much for the insight on this and appreciate making some time for us here.
Thank you, Rob.
Another gambling scandal rocking the world of professional sports, this time in the NBA, as former Toronto Raptors center Jontay Porter has been suspended for life due to his betting activities, betting on basketball, betting on the Raptors to lose, sharing injury information with bettors, even pulling himself from a game where a considerable bet had been placed on his activities in that game. So joining us to talk more about the fallout from this, we're pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Jeremy Luke, President and CEO with the Canadian Centre for Ethics in Sport. CCES.ca is the website. Jeremy, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So this is pretty serious, I think, as far as these kinds of scandals go. What were your initial thoughts, first of all, when you heard about this?
Well, I wasn't surprised, to be honest. I think with the legalization of single event sport betting in Canada over the last couple of years and the proliferation of advertising we're seeing around our professional sports, the issue of competition manipulation or match fixing was inevitable. And this is, you know, a case that we've now heard of, but I think there'll be more to come.
Is it different now? I mean, we think, you know, Pete Rose scandal, for example. I mean, we obviously have had issues like this in sports prior to this new era of legalized gambling. What's different now in your view?
I think what's different is it's the mass exposure of gambling that we're seeing around our sports, whether it's professional sports or other sports. And you see the advertisements, the more and more people are aware of these things, there's more gambling happening. And with that comes risks of being able to fix parts of those competitions. And now it's not so much fixing the outcome of the competition. It's more the types of things you've referenced around this particular situation, trading insider information, betting on component parts or prop lines that really make sport vulnerable to gambling. And I think that's why we're seeing more of it now.
Well, in this case, I mean, the NBA has certainly brought the hammer down. So it's, you know, someone who's now been banned for life. Do you think that sends a strong enough message, or what are your thoughts on how the NBA has handled this?
Well, I think it requires a strong response for sure. And the fact that the NBA has a policy in place and that they were able to identify these irregularities in the betting patterns and investigate this, I think is a positive sign so that people can have confidence that they're taking the matter seriously and they're looking into it. But I think that is absolutely necessary given there's also commercial relationships with the NBA and betting operators and things of that nature that people also see.
You know, in this case, too, so there was an $80,000 bet, as we understand, that was placed, maybe not by Porter himself, but was placed on his stat line in a certain game, sort of betting that he wouldn't meet certain thresholds. And in that game, he took himself out early, which would have paid off that bet. But I guess it was flagged by whatever company the bet was placed with. How much solace, if any, do we take in that?
I think, you know, what's required here now that there's legalized single event sport betting and there's the ability to bet in game on so many different aspects of games. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, in the sport of tennis, I think there's 60 or 70 bets that can be placed before you get to the outcome of the actual competition.
Wow.
So given the volume and the way that gambling is happening, what is required is a really sophisticated response by sporting leagues to make sure that they have the tools to be able to police this effectively and to provide confidence to those who watch the sport that it's, you know, the sport's happening with integrity and to be able to protect the safety of those who participate in sport, because there are instances we know of where individuals can be coerced or groomed into doing these types of things as well. So it's really important that we take the matter seriously to protect both the safety of our athletes, but also the integrity of our competitions.
You know, is this genie out of the bottle? Like, is there no going back when it comes to legalized gambling, or could we dial it back in some respects? Maybe certain kinds of bets or prop bets, maybe that could be better regulated. How do we approach it on that side, do you think?
I think there could be a combination. I think there is some restrictions that could be put in place for sure. I think with the legalization of single event sport betting by the federal government a couple of years ago, what was lacking was the measures that needed to come with it to reduce harm. Really, the goal in legalizing gambling was it's already happening illegally. Let's take it out of the black market, regulate mm-hmm. it. Tax it and be able to protect the individuals who participate in it. But what hasn't flowed from my perspective is the necessary harm reductions, which would be policies, would be laws so that criminals can be convicted for these types of things. None of that has really flowed from the legalization. And that's where I think the federal government could step up and put in place those types of restrictions.
In terms of, you know, these kinds of activities and how criminal law addresses it, I mean, if I try to entice a professional athlete to throw a game or, you know, mail it in and you know, not put in an effort, that sort of thing, am I running afoul of the law? Would that individual be running afoul of the law? How is that addressed?
It's not clear. So one of the points that the Canadian Centre for Ethics and Sport advocated for gambling was legalized, single event sport gambling was legalized, was that the government ratify what's called the Council of Europe Convention which is a convention that puts in place a framework for governments around the world that want to follow it. It's voluntary, but it sets out the steps that governments can take to really make sure that they can deal with these types of issues. And one of the recommendations in that framework is that your criminal code has specific provisions that deal with this issue, so that that way, if it happens, it can be addressed that way. But it can also ensure that law enforcement's cooperating and that betting operators and regulators in our provinces would be feeding this information into law enforcement so that we can ensure we have the proper systems in place to investigate this and to manage it should it happen.
Does that maybe mean, you know, do we need to change the criminal code? Do we need to make it more clear that certain kinds of activities are criminal?
I think what's really necessary, as I mentioned, is that there was a decision made to legalize single event sport betting, and an amendment was put in the criminal code to remove the fact that that was illegal.
Right.
What's really needed is a concerted effort by the government to say, what are the steps we now need to take since we've done this to make sure that we're protecting people who participate in sport and people who watch sport and the integrity of sport. And certainly one of those things might be further amendments to the criminal code.
I do wonder, too, I mean, as much as maybe this story is a wake-up call, that this came to light is a positive thing. I wonder if, though, there's some complacency that might follow because, okay, well, you know, we found out about this, we stopped it, we caught the guy, he was punished, the system worked, we don't need to worry. I mean, is that part of your fear here that we just kind of assume that we don't need to make changes because this guy was caught?
What I'd really encourage your listeners to also consider is that we have a number of sporting leagues in Canada, national sport organizations, our Olympic sports, all of which can also be bet on in some way. Sometimes that they're not permitted to be bet on, but they can still be bet on through illegal channels. So there are other sporting organizations that we really want to make sure have policies in place and education in place to protect those athletes as well. So I don't think it only extends to professional sport, and that's something at the Center for Ethics and Sport we're really strongly trying to bring forward is a national policy that can apply to all of our national sport organizations to make sure that they're protected from this issue as well.
Absolutely. Well, much more on all of this is mentioned, ccess.ca, the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport. Jeremy, thanks so much for your insight on all of this. Appreciate you making some time for us here today.
No problem. Thanks for your interest in the topic.
Well, we got the Calgary Underground Film Festival kicking off this week, and this coming Saturday night at the Globe Cinema is the Calgary premiere of The Last Video Store, a love letter to the era of the video store and the slasher film. Now, our next three guests are all going to be in attendance. We've got with us here this afternoon directors Cody Kennedy and Tim Rutherford, and also lead actor Kevin Martin, all joining us here this afternoon. Gentlemen, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having us on, Rob.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Well, first, we'll start here with Tim and Cody, because you guys co-directed about a decade ago, I think, a short film of the same name. So tell us a bit more about the origins of this project, The Last Video Store.
For sure. I mean, not only did we direct this short film for The Last Video Store in 2013, but we kind of created a whole world within the video store with a few other shorts beforehand. Basically, I guess the quick condensed version of it is that Tim and I met in high school. We were making short films. Kevin was running a film festival in Edmonton called Deadfest, and they started doing contests for filmmakers to create a short film and enter the contest and get your film screened before some of the movies. And Tim and I did that. We met Kevin through that. We ended up creating a little bit of a short film that was like a homage to Michael Biehn, we just haven't left the video store since then. We just kind of kept on making them because people kept wondering what we were doing next, and then eventually we decided to make a bit of a standalone short film called The Last Video Store in 2013, made a web series after that, got the band back together, made another short film called The Video Store Commercial that played at South by Southwest in 2019, and it kind of rolled into this.
I think there's some nostalgia that I think is kind of universal in a lot of ways. So, Tim, maybe elaborate on that if you can. Just, you know, the connection to that era, the fascination with the video store, the films of that era. What is it to you?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, we were very privileged to have kind of Kevin at our disposal in the, like, end of that era. So, you know, we got to grow up in the 80s and 90s, kind of going to the video store, picking movies based on usually sometimes just how good their cover was. And then if you were very lucky, you'd have somebody like Kevin, like an enthusiast that works there, that would kind of like take you on these cinematic journeys. And I think that, you know, once we kind of met Kevin and seen the video store, and it was just such like a rich environment with such a strong community around it, we just kind of drifted into that. So I think that like some of that nostalgia just hasn't really left for us, because we've been making these films in the video store and like about Kevin, trying to like encapsulate that experience of having like a movie aficionado kind of curate your entertainment.
Well, yeah, Kevin, let's bring you in, because you play in the movie the owner of the video store, and in real life, you are the owner of the video store. So it's a little bit meta. I don't know. Is this kind of like a version of yourself in this movie?
Yeah, absolutely, Rob. Obviously, playing, yeah, you're right, it is very meta. Playing myself for the last decade or so with these fine directors, it's evolved from, you know, not quite sure what I'm doing to, I think I've separated enough of my real self and the final version of me in the feature movie. But yeah, it's still a version of me, just kind of ramped up about 30%. He's a little grumpier, maybe a little bit more insane about the movies. And yeah, it's very, it is meta, but it's been like a 10-year crazy journey with these guys. And yeah, they've immortalized the real video store as I literally sit in the real video store right now as we speak. And I'm like, oh yeah, we made a movie about all this. This is crazy.
Well, tell us, yeah, a bit more about your store. It's called The Lobby. It's in Edmonton, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've had the shop for, it'll be 19 years this summer. I'm right on White Ave. So I'm kind of in the right part of the city to like cater to that kind of clientele. Had the store for all this time, haven't made a dime, still working the bar industry at night, but you know, sometimes money isn't everything. And, it's just crazy how like opening this store, you know, back in 2005 has led to like lack of funds. Sure. But cultural commodity, we got it in plenty, whether it was the film festival meeting Tim and Cody. And of course, you know, making these crazy movies and going to their film festivals with it. I had no idea I'd be the last video store in Edmonton per se, but here we are. And I feel like I'm obliged to keep the store open to remind the younger generation of whatever they think they like is a good movie is based off something older and better. So let me show you the ways.
That's right. Yeah. I think one of the last in Canada, right?
There's more than you'd think. There's a few kick around North America. We're a close group, but yeah, it's definitely getting there. Definitely getting there.
All right. So, Cody, let me go back to you, because, you know, it makes sense, obviously, then to work with Kevin to include him in this. But so a lot of this was actually shot right in the store then.
Yeah. I mean, so this film itself, we did build a set that was based on Kevin's real store, just because we had shot the film in Ontario, because that's just where the production was. But like all of our short films were shot inside Kevin's real store. And it was just kind of a natural, like, it didn't really... you know, when we started, we didn't, you know, we would never have expected it to just go this far. And Kevin just has so much natural charisma on screen. We just kind of kept on pulling him in, using him, just kind of based the world around Kevin, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask Tim, you know, sort of bigger picture when it comes to, you know, this kind of a project and making the movies you want to make and telling the stories you want to make and, you know, what you guys worked on here, like what are the challenges, you know, the practical challenges these days for filmmakers then in doing something like this?
I mean, we had attempted actually a feature in 2014 after the success of the short film. We got a little bit of grant money and we're dead set on trying to tell a similar story, expanded into the, you know, the complexities of a feature. And that just didn't really work out very well because we just didn't have a lot of money. So I think, you know, a lot of it comes down to not only being able to find your community that kind of wants and kind of needs this story to be told, but also finding the people that will help you bring that to life with a lot of money, really, is what it comes down to. Is it is like a steep hill to climb, and it was a part of the reason why it was such a long journey for us, because it is such an obscure and kind of like niche market and community. And even the nostalgia of being in a video store, not everybody has had these kinds of crazy experiences, and like to bring that to life and to sell that idea was like a long process. And I think the endurance part of that also, and having a lot of like faith in your friends and your story, can go a long way to help you carry that, and knowing that not everything's going to happen very quickly. We had a lot of success with the web series and the shorts, and it still took as long as it did. You know, it's kind of, it's to some extent like the band that tours their, you know, top 10 songs for 10 years before they get their first album. And it feels a little bit like that. And now we're just hoping to take that momentum forward.
You know, Kevin mentioned the close-knit community of the remaining video stores, right? Because, you know, I think there's some commonalities between us and the Americans in that sense. But this is still like a Canadian film. It certainly showcases Canadian and even Alberta talent. Are you deliberate about certain elements in that sense, or Canadianizing a movie, if you will?
Well, definitely. I think we don't shy away from it. We make a big point of doing Canucksploitation. And I think there's an element of that, like, you know, kind of low budget kind of Canadian humor that is built into the stories that we kind of naturally tell, and the experiences that we've had in the video store. I think that kind of like B-movie culture is definitely something that, you know, made me think of video stores in particular, because it's very difficult to find that kind of content in the modern world.
Yeah, did you want to add on that, Cody?
Canada has such a rich history of, you know, comedic comedy. So it was just fun to kind of just really lay into that Canadian humor as much as we could, and hoping that it would hit.
Yeah, and is that just Kevin, you being you, or how did you approach it?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, like it's funny, like, yeah, Canucks. The movie, I don't think we intended it at first to be a straight-on Canucksploitation movie, but as more of our fellow friends and filmmakers that also are very Canadian, that we admire their independent movies, decided to help us out and show up in our movie and work on some of the background stuff with Tim and Cody, it just organically turned into a Canucksploitation film. It was funny when we had the world premiere in Austin, Texas, a fantastic fest. There were a lot of jokes I think went over American audiences' heads. But then when we showed it, you know, here in Edmonton, they laughed at all the right beats. So I'm like, that's when it dawned on us, like, yep, this is very Canadian. I mean, we didn't think it was, but it is. But yeah, it all came together organically as far as the final product anyways.
So as we mentioned, we got the premiere. It's coming up this Saturday, 9:45, Saturday night at Globe Cinema. And there's a second screening on April 28th. That's a Sunday at 3:15. So more details at CalgaryUndergroundFilm.org. But all three of you are going to be in attendance. What should folks expect?
Well, yeah, we'll definitely see a kind of a tighter version, I guess, of what they may have seen in Edmonton earlier. So we got kind of like the more finalized version. So I think that's something to be really excited about. And I think you'll see a lot of our team there as well. So definitely take a moment to thank Brandon for his incredible music.
And as far as the story itself, Rob, if people haven't seen it, I consider it a B-movie video store adventure film with that'll hopefully bring back the love of video store culture that those that grew up in that era in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s.
And you can expect us all hanging out after. And if anyone wants to come watch it, come up and let's all have a drink.
Right on.
Pretty much.
So it's definitely a movie that you want to, you know, maybe have a couple of drinks if you can. I think I'm not sure if the drinking in theaters, but let's do it.
Well, the festival is always a fun time. It will be a fun time Saturday night for sure. The movie is called The Last Video Store, as mentioned. The Calgary premiere this Saturday night at the Globe Cinema, part of the Calgary Underground Film Festival. Cody, Tim, Kevin, thank you so much for making some time for us here today. Really appreciate this.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rob.
Yep. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.